Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How smart are America's young people? It might depend on how you measure it. While some studies find the capacity for intelligence is higher among the millennial generation than any that has come before it, a distressing number of surveys indicate they are not doing much with those big brains of theirs. Many are reading less than 10 minutes a day for pleasure, but spending hours in front of video and computer screens, and more young people can identify the current American idol than the current Speaker of the House. All this really worries Emory University English professor Mark Bauerlein, who writes about the phenomenon in his new book, The Dumbest Generation: How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
We should say here that the title is a little out there. It's not that you don't trust anyone under 30. You're just worried about what they're doing with their minds.
Well, I've had to explain to some young people who've called me or written me letters that subtitle, Don't Trust Anyone Under 30, is kind of a riff over that old 1960s slogan, Don't Trust Anyone Over 30. But you're certainly right. It's a provocative title. And what one tries to do sometimes is to provoke in order to get an issue on the table. And in one of the interesting responses I have gotten is a lot of kids who do write me, and they're offended by this, as they should be, really. But I take that offense response as a good sign. It means they're paying attention, for one thing. It means that they care enough about intellectual values to argue back. And in those cases, when we've had some good exchanges and they've made some strong points, I like nothing better than conceding a point to a bright 18-year-old.
Can you talk about some of the facts and the information that young people do not seem to know in large numbers today that were probably just a given a generation or two ago?
Well, I'll give you one on the 2001 National Assessment of Educational Progress test in U.S. history. That's the nation's report card, as it's called. One of the questions on that exam for 12th graders was, can you name of the following countries, which one was our ally in World War II? 52% of test takers chose Germany, Italy, or Japan, not the Soviet Union. More than half of them chose one of the Axis powers against us. Now, that's just a little fact that you see, but they crop up all over the place. I was talking to a crowd of students at the University of Maryland a while back, and about 200 of them in the audience, and I told them the truth. I said, now, on surveys, you guys are six times more likely to know who is the latest American idol than you are to know who is the Speaker of the House just a few miles down the road there and in the Capitol. Of course, at one point, one young woman in the back yelled out, idol is more important. That actually reveals really what does count in their world. In their social lives, what would happen if, a 15-year-old got on the bus and then went back and hung out with the gang and said, hey, did you guys read the op-ed in the morning news this morning about school funding? The others would look at him and wonder, who is this? This is a strange person in our midst. And that, I think, is the real contrast you find between youth culture and those adult matters of history and civics and foreign affairs and so on.
Well, and your point is, I think back to my own days in high school, and we weren't talking a lot about the op-eds on the bus, but we had more time with our adult mentors back then who said, yes, this is important, jam it through your thick skull because it matters to you.
Chris, you're right, and young people today are just as bright and maybe even more motivated than kids ever before. I mean, more of them are taking AP courses in high school. The more of them are going to college. A lot of them have professional ambitions. But what you find is that in the past, you did have some balance, more or less, between their social time, the time they spend with one another, talking to one another, and the time they spend around parents and other mentors in their lives, not just in school, but out of school. So that, I'm 50 years old. When I was 15, I'd go to school in the morning, go to classes, hang out with friends at lunch, go to classes, go home, play a little basketball for a while. At 6 p.m., I went home for dinner, and that was it. Social life was pretty much over. There was the landline, but that was nothing compared to what you have today. And I couldn't be back in touch with all the crowd until the next morning. And I had to be around my parents. I had to listen to them complain about Richard Nixon, and I had to listen to Walter Cronkite on Vietnam. And I couldn't check out. I couldn't go somewhere else. Today, that private space of the bedroom, deep in the home, that's a social space at this point. That's a command center for a lot of kids, and their social lives in that room at midnight are often more dynamic than their FaceTime, you know, in the daylight hours with friends sitting at the lunch table.
Meaning that they are online, they're instant messaging, they're texting each other.
Right, and Chris, a lot of people don't realize just how deep the immersion is. 4 out of 5 teenagers have their own mobile device, a cell phone or iPhone or BlackBerry. They average 1,742 text messages each month. Those are Nielsen's ratings. 1,742, about 60 per day. That doesn't include the cell phone calls that they make, the Facebooking that they do, the email, the chatting, the web surfing. And so this social time is now a 24/7 thing. They are conscious of stuff going on, pictures going up of the party last week, text messages going back and forth, gossip and boasting and bullying and all the usual stuff that kids have always done. Now they have a nonstop dynamic network in place so that even when kids are disconnected, when they're logged off, things are happening. And they're conscious of things happening. And so if they do stay out for many hours, they start getting nervous. They leave my classroom, and the first thing they do is flip open that cell phone and check in. Something may have happened in the last 2 hours, and the stakes are high. It could say a text message, "I don't think we should see each other anymore," you know, period. And so until they get oriented, I see concern on their faces. People could be meeting somewhere. I've got to go join them. Someone could have written something, you know, on my Facebook page. And that is the peer pressure now, which has always existed, right? But now it's all peers all the time. Again, in the middle of the night, in your bed, laptop open, chat with a buddy 1,000 miles away or a buddy down the street. And this makes it harder and harder for those adult voices to come through, for those adult influences to hit the 17-year-old and remind them, you know, there are bigger heroes and villains in this world than the popular crowd in senior class. There are more important things happening in the world than you getting your driver's license. That's what the adult voices mean, and they had more of an impact 25 years ago before all these digital tools came into play.
Of course, Mark, you can't consider this reality without realizing that it wasn't these kids who invented these technologies. It was us Gen Xers and baby boomers who put this stuff out there for these kids.
And you know, we feel it as well. I mean, whenever I have to read something in my office more than 10 pages long, I've got to go. I've got to go somewhere and get away because I'm going to check my email. I'm going to go look at the UCLA football blog. I'm going to check the stock market. I can make a phone call. There's always something to do, and these tools, they are tempting. They pull you in. So I go to a theology library where they have no access, where I can sit and focus. So certainly these factors affect adults, and you know that the fastest-growing Facebook population now is the over 35 crowd.
So
I have a theory for why that is.
I guess that no longer means it's cool, so maybe it'll lose its grip on the teenagers.
well, you know, people, they hit 50 years old, and they're starting to think about their life, and they feel, you know, they're on the downhill side, and they start thinking about when life was fresh and young, and they go back to their high school sweethearts, and they wonder, I wonder what happened to that person. Facebook keeps you in touch once again.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's funny. I work from my home in the afternoons preparing for the show for the exact same reason, because there are fewer distractions. Why is it that you think that we can control this and teenagers and young people can't? Maybe they're able to balance all of this information.
Well, I think that if you put 40-year-olds, first of all, into the same kind of spaces that we crowd 17-year-olds, put them all in a building, have them have lockers next to one another, shuffle them from classroom to classroom, make them go to the gym and compete in sports. You know, all of the tribal rituals that are set up by those close spaces of high school, we might act just the same way. That's one thing. The other thing is there is a real age intensity for adolescents. 15-year-olds, they care about other 15-year-olds. The difference between 15 and 18 is another universe, whereas the difference between 35 and 38, that's nothing. So they are moving so quickly. They're changing so rapidly over time. Their sexuality is going crazy. Their egos are very fragile because they're in that delicate threshold between childhood and adulthood. They don't know where they're going or where they're going to end up. They want to be independent, but they don't have the equipment or the composure to be independent yet. They're thinking about their own mortality. Their hormones are going crazy. These are all the things that come into play and accentuate the social impact of these tools.
So I think a lot of parents can certainly relate to what you're saying and may, in fact, want to limit their kids' access to these communication technologies, but worry that there will be a social consequence for their child if they say, you're not going to have a cell phone or you're only going to have a computer in the main spaces of the house. Is that a valid concern?
I think it's a valid concern because so much of their social lives are managed by these tools. So when the parent gets that phone bill, you know, that ends up being 10 pages long and that there are 3,500 text messages on there, the parent who says, all right, this is a silly, expensive little toy, I'm taking it away. Well, for the 17-year-old, the response is different. You have destroyed my life. Those are the stakes that they feel. So you don't just take these cell phones away. What you do is you try to provide a more healthy balance. Sure, do your text messaging, go on your Facebook page, you know, keep up with your buddies. But for an hour after dinner, we're all just going to have a little downtime. Maybe we will listen to some intelligent radio. We'll go watch C-SPAN for a while. We will read the op-ed page, or we'll all just read our own thing. You want to read a Conan book, you know, 14-year-old boy? Fine. My 13-year-old girl wants to read a Nancy Drew? Fine. But the parents have to do it too. They can't just say, go to your room and read a book. The parents have to have some downtime as well, in part to model for their kids, this is what adults do. You know, we have some time to reflect, to think about ideas and to read stories and characters and take words seriously. And after that hour is over, go back to your stuff. You know, go ahead and check in on things. But being vigilant in carving out a space in your kids' lives has never been more essential. And a lot of parents don't realize it because they didn't have to do that so much because they didn't have the network in play so much. I mean, when I was growing up, we had, in the 70s, there were 5 TV stations. That's it. One landline, you know, one phone downstairs in the kitchen. So the empowerment of teenagers now is a whole new thing for parents to take into account.
Mark Bauerlein is my guest. He's professor of English at Emory University. His new book is called The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to be part of it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Emory University Professor of English Mark Bauerlein. His new book is called The Dumbest Generation: How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Mark, we have more kids enrolled in college in this country than ever before, and you teach at a very prestigious university. Are colleges having to dumb things down to accommodate these students?
Well, we've had a great inflation in high school and in college for quite a while. And while I think that everyone can go to many, many colleges in this country and get an excellent education, it's also pretty easy for students to pick and choose in the curriculum to find those courses that aren't going to challenge them that much, that aren't going to make them work very hard. A lot of departments need to try to build up their enrollments because that boosts their power and prestige on the campus and justifies their existence. And so there's a pressure to sort of regard students more and more, especially when they're paying so doggone much money for tuition in a lot of places, to regard them more as customers and consumers rather than students who are there for a rigorous education. So there are a lot of pressures, I think, to not be quite as rigorous or tough as we used to be with students. But you're quite right. More of them are going to college than ever before, and college seems to be a natural step for many, many students. What distresses me about a lot of this culture that they grow with. On the one hand, you've got an achievement culture out there for young people where their orientation in terms of their education is what can go onto a syllabus, what can go onto a resume, what looks good on a transcript, good grades, good test scores. And so those intellectual activities that don't show up in some nice, neat, objective measure, well, they don't really count. They don't help them to get into the top schools. If they spend a summer reading novels by Jane Austen and Charles Dickens and Henry James, it's a very worthwhile activity. But you can't put that down on your job application letter. It doesn't have any place on the college admissions data sheet when you record your GPA and the like. And so that broader intellectual formation, the development of yourself as a learned, responsible citizen in a free republic, often that just goes by the wayside. And the intellectual curiosity that they should have, well, that wanes as well. And I think that there is a connection between that and the extensive peer-to-peer contact that they have. What they end up doing is dividing school time, school content from leisure time. Learning history, learning about the Gettysburg Address and Abraham Lincoln, well, that's just for a class. That's what I do to fulfill assignments, to know for the test. When I'm out of school, I hang out with my friends. So that as their characters form, as their values develop, their beliefs, their tastes evolve, what are the raw materials for that? Not Abraham Lincoln and George Washington and FDR or Barack Obama even. It is one another. They look to themselves as the raw materials of their character instead of taking some of these liberal arts materials that they learn in class as something to take to heart, something that has personal meaning for them that should last well beyond the class. You know, one person once put it, in this situation, what students learn in the course stays in the course. You know, a month after taking the test, the learning is gone. Again, because it didn't sink in. It wasn't meaningful to them.
Well, when you write about the fact that their relationship to books and to literature is changing, and those things are becoming, for many, of course, we're generalizing here, but for sure, many young people, not as important, you also make this point that I think can't be overstated, which is that that time in your life when you have so much free time may be the only real opportunity you have to read the classics and do these things that later, when you're raising kids and starting your first career, just you absolutely don't have time for them.
Indeed. Those high school and college years, those are the time when you have the setup in your life to do a lot of your intellectual homework, to form the foundations of yourself, your mind, your character, your personality that will stand you for a long, long time into adulthood. And if you don't do it then, you're not going to. You're not going to be 35 years old. You have kids. You get home from work. You make dinner. You clean up. You do the laundry. Get the kids to bed. And then at 10 o'clock at night, you're going to say, okay, now let's get back to Dante's Divine Comedy. Or let's read the Federalist Papers for a while. No, you're tired. It's too long. And you don't have the threat of a teacher or the guidance of a teacher to help lead you through it. The thing about the reading side is one reason why kids are reading fewer books these days is it's just not worked into the rhythms of their life today to sit in a chair for 2 hours by themselves without interruption and read 100 pages in a book. Too many things are happening. They've got the text messages to send, the phone, the BlackBerry buzzes, an email came through or a phone call comes through. They've got to check in with their friends. It's a very frenetic pace that they live in now, and book reading requires some downtime, some leisure time, and it's slow. It seems really, really slow to them. When you watch them online, go to the library and stand behind students, young people online, they're either racing through those web pages or they're typing out messages, and it sounds like a machine gun, so fast. Slow down for a minute. Think. Ponder. And I actually sympathize with the kids. It's an anxiety that has gotten into their heads because they've been doing this for so many years now that deliberation, that pause, okay, that slow pace of good reading and good writing, it's uncomfortable for them. When I have students in my classes memorize poems, and I do that a lot, memorize poems and stand in front of the class and recite them. They hate it. After they do it, they feel a great sense of accomplishment. When they stand up and they get it right, the joy comes over their faces because they were so tense at the start. But when you memorize a poem, it's really slow. You've got to look at pauses, punctuation, metaphors, rhymes, and that works against that the texting mode, the web browsing mode. But it's a really important activity. It's a discipline, an exercise for the mind. And it's that we're losing. The concentration, the focus, the plunging into a dense, difficult text for a long time. That's what we lose in a lot of their web activities.
Mark Bauerlein is my guest. The new book is called The Dumbest Generation. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Don in Arlington. Hey, Don.
Hi. I am not sure if I completely agree about your age being the really uninformed. I myself am 57, and I was one time talking to kind of one of my peers who claimed to be a political junkie. And I said, well, I can talk to this guy. And it just so happened at the time that the Speaker of the House, the State House, was having some political problems. And this has been about 10 years ago. As I mentioned his name, he had no idea who the Speaker of the House was. And through chance, I actually knew him personally and had talked to him personally, so I had some inside information. But at any rate, the fact that we have people that are in their, and I've found this to be true, that people seem to be in their 50s, and my contemporary is 57, that have no idea what's happening at the local level. They have no idea who their state representative is. They have no idea what's going on at the school board. They have no idea what's going on at the city council level.
Yeah, I think those are great points, Don, and I appreciate your call. What do you think about that, Mark? Are there are uninformed people clearly existing right now in every generation?
No, I think that's a fair point, and we don't want to make big claims for previous generations, certainly. I think that there are a couple of differences, though, and these may be over subtle differences, but one, I think that the respect for historical knowledge and civic knowledge has gone down. That we did have someone who would want to claim, who's 55 years old, who would believe that it's really important to know a lot about politics. I mean, the ideal is in place there. Well, I see a lot of 20-year-olds who flout that ideal. And again, in my own narrow experience, I think that has gotten worse. The respect for civic and historical knowledge has gone down. And one reason it's gone down is, and I've had many young people say this, and actually older people say this, well, why do they need to know all those facts? They can just get them online. When I last time I made the assignment of memorizing poems, a student in the front said, why? And she wasn't trying to be impudent or difficult. She genuinely didn't understand. Why would I memorize an Emily Dickinson poem? I can always get it with a couple of clicks. And so the ready availability of historical and civic knowledge, it's a wonderful thing. The internet gives us so much, but on the other hand, it makes young people think that, well, if it's all out there, I don't really need to internalize it. I don't really need to take it in and respect it so much. It's always out there whenever I want to get it. So that I think I would concede the caller's point with that addition. I'll also add that there were certain historical and civic materials that everyone was expected to know as part of being a citizen. I mean, 100 years ago, the central event of the 4th of July in the United States was not a fireworks display. It was all over the country in big cities and small cities and communities. You would have a little parade of some kind, and then you would have a public reading of the entire Declaration of Independence. Everyone, it was understood, had to know those words, had to understand the principles and ideals enunciated in that document. That's what we celebrate. That ritual's gone. We don't have that civic understanding anymore, and I think that is a regrettable decline.
I wonder how you think this phenomenon is wrapped up in what a lot of people have documented as a kind of extension of adolescence in this country, whereas we used to sort of feel like adults at 20 or 21. Now it takes 5 or 6 years to get through undergrad. A lot of people then add graduate school in the end, and we're certainly not knocking education here, but people are living at home longer. They're counting on their parents longer. Do you think this is part of that?
I think it is. It's a very important part of it, the extension of adolescence well into their 20s. You know, I have a friend who's about 60 years old. He grew up in the 50s and 60s. He went to high school in the Bay Area. And he told me, I mean, this is a brilliant guy. He speaks about 7 languages. And he's a journalist now. But he said the day of his high school graduation, he went down to the docks in Oakland with his best friend. And they signed up for the Merchant Marine. They didn't go to college. They didn't hang out with their friends. And a month later, he was in the middle of the Pacific on a boat heading over to China. And I said, why did you do that? He said, the last thing I wanted to do was to be around my friends anymore. I wanted to be a man. I wanted to be around other older people. And I wanted to prove to myself that I could, you know, be an adult, be a man. That attitude, I think, was much more common than it is today. And what I see among college students now is instead of college being a threshold where you leave high school and all of that world behind, a lot of them try to extend high school mores and social life into college. And the digital tools certainly help them do that. They can keep in touch with all their friends. They can remain connected. And when you're talking about the transition from adolescence to adulthood, I think it is important to leave some of these things behind. It's not pleasant. Growing up can be pretty hard. Leaving people behind is a hard thing to do. but it's also, I think, crucial for the maturing process.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Bob in Plano. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Good. This is really a great subject, Mark. I'm glad you're addressing it.
And, thank you.
And, you know, it's amazing how often this comes up in conversation with the friends in my arena. I'm in the – my friends group is probably in the mid-30s to right around 60 probably. And this conversation is constant about what's happening at that level, at that age level. And I think one of the things that you probably touch on in your book is what a cop-out this whole thing is as an opportunity for these kids in their developmental stages. If they have an issue or a problem with one of their friends or whoever, all they got to do is just text it away. You know, they don't have to face anybody. They don't have to face confrontation.
Sort of like that breakup over text message that you talked about, Mark.
All breakups are by text message now. It's crisp and
God,
clean.
That's so awful.
I almost envy them that I didn't have that at my, you know, when I was 25 years old.
There's no, we need to talk. We need to just, no. It's probably an abbreviation for it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the numeral 2 instead of TO. I agree with the caller. And, you know, one thing I hear from people in the workplace is there's a whole industry now of human resource consultants to talk to older workers about these young workers coming into the workplace. And often the orientation is you've got to adjust to these new millennials. They think differently. They regard work differently. And they have a hard time relating to 50-year-olds. They're great on relating to other 25-year-olds, but you are different to them. And you know, you don't go. They're not going to go in the mailroom and work their way up anymore.
Mark Bauerlein is my guest. We're talking about his new book, The Dumbest Generation, which is now out in paperback. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Mark Bauerlein is my guest. His new book is called The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Elizabeth in Frisco, who writes, I remember being a child in the 80s when the Generation X articles came out. There was so much talk about how messed up and selfish we were as a group that I started to have real concerns for the future. I think we turned out okay, and the world has survived us coming of age. Has there ever been a generation that the adults that came before did not see them as a more stupid group? Mark?
You know, the elders have been complaining about the juniors forever. The complaints have varied. You know, 50 years ago it was Elvis, and then Generation X as well. But I have a few takes on that. One, yes, they have been doing so, but I think one of the jobs of older people is to criticize younger people precisely for their adolescence. I mean, why would a 15-year-old care about what happened on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in the summer of 1963 when Martin Luther King took the podium? They care about what happened in the lunchroom that week. Life is very immediate for them. And the horizon is pretty small. The high school. I mean, why should they care about, you know, Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln? Their idols are the popular crowd in the senior class. So one of the things that the elder voice does is to let them know that there are bigger and better things to focus on. And if elders don't do that, the young are not going to do that by themselves. And so that's what makes a society healthy. And I also think that it's a good thing for the young to resent that and to think that, well, you older people are getting kind of rigid and authoritarian. I think some tension between the generations helps ensure the flow of knowledge and values and civility, even, from one generation to the next. And so that's a job that we have. And I think that for many elders today, especially in the field of education, they don't like that job. A lot of them came of age in the 60s and 70s when the youth movement was in full swing, and now they're old. They occupy the position of the, you know, capital E establishment, and they're a little uncomfortable with the authority that they have over young people, and they don't want to judge the cultural values and leisure behaviors of the young. They don't want to appear old. They don't want to be old-fashioned, reactionary, cranky curmudgeons. And so I think that I see teachers come in, and they want to be friends with the students. They want to be relevant. I actually find that young people want older people to play a more authoritative role in their lives, if only to give them something meaningful to rebel against. So I take the point, and this has happened for a long, long time, but I think that it should happen. And Generation X, one thing that we do see about Generation X is that, and when we see the millennials improving on Generation X, is in their civic engagement. And the voting rates by the millennials is much higher than voting rates for Generation X when they were young. In fact, it was the lowest in history when Generation X was in their 20s. We had voting rates that were abysmal on their part.
One thing I think that's interesting when you talk about that loss of sort of healthy tensions between the generations is this idea that, you know, not only have we lost the tension that would be good for younger people, but some of it's good for older people. If we sort of sit here and refuse to engage with them, then we also lose the ability to really understand what it is they're up to.
I mean, you want to give them a critical take on their own culture. One thing about youth culture is kids feel within it. They're so immersed in it, and it carries so much social value that they feel, you know, I have to wear these pants. I have to like this music. I have to speak in this way. I have to wear my hair this way. All the other kids are doing it. So they have no distance on the things that come into their world every day. That adult voice will help give them some distance on that, some alternative to what they are experiencing it. And even if the kids reject it, at least that rejection means they have to do it on better grounds than just accepting it, just living it out. And also, it does put adults into, I think, a healthier intellectual relationship. I mean, when a lot of people have said, boy, your students must hate you with this attitude. Well, what I find is if students were abandoning my courses, then I would change the attitude that I have. But I get pretty good enrollments, and the students hear me say, look, you guys got to watch a lot less TV and start reading more books. Or I'll say in front of the class, okay, we're going to go around the class, and each person is going to say, what are the three books you're going to read this summer? Okay, their faces go blank because none of them have chosen three books to read over the summer. I know this. And then we talk about that, and I will rebuke them for that. But I can do that because alongside the criticism is, look, I care about you guys becoming intelligent people. I care about your minds. I expect you to do a lot better than that. And that interest is something that is important to them. I mean, the worst thing for kids is not when elders rebuke them. It's when elders don't pay any attention to them at all. Inattentiveness is worse than criticism. You know, if criticism is not hostile or sadistic, mean-spirited, there is generous-spirited criticism, that is much better than just sort of letting kids go off on their own and do their own thing.
Let's go next to Samantha in Tyler. Hello, Samantha.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier in the show, you asked what would happen if a 15-year-old tried to talk about the latest op-ed with his peers, and I can tell you don't make a lot of friends that way. The only issue that really garnered attention on our campus was whether the precinct nearby was going to legalize liquor sales. But I think it's really important to distinguish also that at the university level, for us, unless you're at a liberal arts or a private university, you're really discouraged from having a well-rounded education. You know, you get accepted and they say, okay, what's your major? You pick a major and your department says, okay, what's your specialization? Because we know that's the only viable way to get a good career. And we joke about how the bachelor's degree is the new diploma. I wonder if the if your guest has anything to say on that.
What do you think, Mark?
I think that's a very good comment, and I'm sort of tempted to let that stand as a better judgment than I can make on that. But yes, the way in which the college curriculum at many places has just become sort of an employment scheme, and not giving students, you know, at least in their first 2 years, time to broaden out, to become sort of liberally educated, take some art history. You want to go into business? Well, how about a year of art history and history and reading some good literature and film classes, or you know, give these young people a chance to develop their minds and their values. No, a lot of them, yeah, they're put on this track of, okay, what kind of job are you going to get? Okay, well, what are you training yourself for? And it takes place too soon. It's too soon in these people's lives for that. So I would echo what the young lady said.
Do you think, though, that some of that comes from parents who say, if I'm spending $60,000 over the next 4 years, you are going to get something out of it that gives you a decent job?
That's right. That's right. What am I paying for? What is this diploma worth? And yeah, a lot of parents are precisely like this. And I think, you know, a lot of college educators, we haven't really made the case to parents saying, among other things, look, you know, these kids have 4 years. It's going to go by real fast, and this is a precious, unique time for them. And, you know, my take on this is that taking some history, becoming generally educated, is a lot more important. Having cultural literacy is more important to professional success than a lot of people think. You know, if a young person comes out of law school and has been so focused on career from day one, hasn't gotten sort of a broader liberal education, that person might interview at a law firm, meet the people. They all like this candidate and seem like a good person to work with. Then that person goes out and has lunch with three of the partners in the law firm who are, you know, in their 50s and 60s, and they're having conversation, and somehow Russia comes up or Putin, and then someone mentions the Cold War, and then they look at the 25-year-old law school hotshot. If he or she has nothing to say about the Cold War, about Russia, if he thinks that the Cold War is about global warming, then it's going to show. And they're going to say, you know, this guy may not bring all that much to the table. So just being conversant about a lot of general issues, I think, is more important in terms of work success in a lot of different fields than people realize.
Let's go next to Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi there. Sorry about that. I really enjoying the show. Driving around caught my attention. I haven't run back in the office yet. So, I'm living this right now. I've got two daughters, 11 and 13, going right through the, you know, the pop culture and the internet and the DVRs. Watch TV whenever your show, favorite show, whenever you want to. And I'm just looking. I'm assuming you have seen enough of this, maybe interviewed people, but I'm looking for some practical advice. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, so we all know that this is a problem. Let's assume, you know, and here comes the summertime, and we've got kids. You know, a lot of them will be at home. You know, do you have any recommendations, let's say, like three things that, you know, we as parents or elders should be working with our children.
Robert, before,
avoid that abyss.
Before we get Mark's answer for you, and I definitely want to get that, let me ask you very briefly to tell me what you're doing right now to try and get a handle on this.
Well, I mean, I probably, I suggest, reading books, but I don't enforce it. I tell them to get off, enough of the internet, go out and play. Same stuff probably, pretty plain vanilla stuff.
Okay. All right. Well, what do you think about that he might try, Mark?
Well, this is going to sound really, really simplistic, but talk to your kids. Spend time to have conversations with them about ideas, about matters of taste, not just about their lives. You can talk to them about what is going on in their lives, but talk to them about things separate from themselves, separate from their social lives, separate from their immediate realities, and genuinely make it an exchange. Make it a conversation. Draw them out. Introduce them into conversation and discourse as an art, as something that you formulate. You learn to articulate your ideas. You learn to reflect on what you believe, to think about it critically, and you become then a point in their lives where you are teaching them something simply by spending time with them in conversation. When you're driving around, talk about things. Raise issues in politics or current affairs or about historical matters. But simply by talking with your kids, engaging them, and forcing them to engage back with you, you're giving them an alternative to what is so powerful in the rest of their lives. And what you hope is that they begin to develop some dissatisfaction with all the text messaging, and they want more. They begin to crave more out of the people they interact with, out of their classes, and that they grow up 25 years old, realize that ideas matter, ideologies matter, values matter, and that this is the stuff out of which a satisfying life is made.
In the last 10 seconds or so, do you think there's a chance these kids will grow out of this without our intervention?
I think a lot of them will grow out of it, but I think a lot of them won't without our intervention. And the more we make it easier for them, the more we provide role models for them, the happier they will be as they get older.
Mark Bauerlein is a professor of English at Emory University. His new book is called The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Mark, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. That was great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.